Well, I'm glad to be back. Thanks so much for having me. As we said, I'm going to talk a little bit tonight about my experience of praying the Lord's Prayer in the Holy Land. So a couple of years ago, it's now almost 3 years ago, I was given the wonderful opportunity to join a cohort of pastors from Dallas and Fort Worth. And I had someone who I didn't know. This man called, and he has a really thick West Texas accent. I know because I'm from West Texas. He said, "Is this Danielle Schroyer?" And I said, "Yes." And he says, "Charlie Johnson here, and I got your name from so-and-so, and I'm calling to see if you want to go on a free trip to the Holy Land." And I thought, what kind of weird call is this? Like, it's not my home. We have a home number. We have a landline, which everybody thinks is funny. But we give that so that, you know, all the people that want our phone call, they just can call our home number and we just hang up on them. But this was my cell phone. And so I was like, is this real? And actually it was. So this ministry from Atlanta offers senior pastors or solo pastors a chance, if they've been in ministry after 7+ years, to go on a 2-week free trip to the Holy Land. You join a cohort of people from your area. You meet monthly for the year in preparation for the trip. And then when you come back, you meet monthly for a year after and think of a way to give back to the community as a sign of gratitude for this trip. And of course, I said yes to that opportunity. So for me, it couldn't have come at a better time because I had just recently made a really difficult decision to transfer out of being a pastor. And I was moving into a role that I was still uncertain about. I knew it probably had to do with writing, but I wasn't exactly sure where it would take me. And I was also in a place that I would lovingly call theologically overstuffed. That's my own doing, because I had at that point spent the better part of 20 years voraciously gobbling up words about God as if they were available for a limited time only. I started probably as a sophomore in high school in earnest. My youth minister loved me. I was like, "What other theology books do you have in your office?" And he was like, "You know, this is weird, right? You're 16. Other girls are thinking about boys right now. Here's Calvin," or whatever. He was Baptist, actually, so he didn't give me Calvin at all. But anyway, after a long time of that, I just got to a point where I felt really saturated. So this also happens to be a note of being a pastor in general, where so much of your daily life consists of God words, either because you're pondering them or writing them or praying them or speaking them to others. And what I found myself longing for more than anything was just time and space. Just time and space to ponder God and life and other things without thinking about how it will connect to a sermon or to somebody I'm praying for, or just allowing my mind to meander and wander without a necessary theological destination. A space in my head to quiet the very busy theological train station that had been my norm. So I don't know if I would call it burnout, but as I said, I think it was definitely saturation. You may not be coming into this season of Lent feeling particularly theologically overstuffed, and that's probably for the best, but these seasons of wanting to draw closer to God are universal, I think. We find ourselves needing that for a lot of reasons, but it all lands us in a place where we're wanting more quiet, more time and space to be with God, more connection. So that's where I was, at least, in this place where I felt like my whole life revolved around God. And yet at the same time, I just didn't feel like I got a lot of time with God. And I just wanted that. I just wanted to be with God, just for the sake of being with God, with no other thing on the agenda. Faith can so easily become talking about or doing, even, and we forget the importance of being with. And so I was talking about Jesus all the time, and really I wanted to just be with Jesus and shut up already. So I asked myself before I went on this trip, what do you need most of all to feel renewed and refreshed on this pilgrimage? And to that end, I made one rule for myself: less words. I need less words. No theological books in the backpack. In fact, no books at all in the backpack, which was maybe the most brave thing I have ever done, leaving on a trip with including a quiet airport, like a long airline ride, and I didn't have a book to read. I just still think I squandered that time, but nevertheless, it was important. No excessive journaling. I told myself I could take minor notes to remember, but no writing in earnest. And most importantly, no wordy prayers to God. Just be with God. Don't tell God anything. Just be with God. Be silent. Just time and space. So I boarded the plane to Israel with my cohort, and I felt very naked without my books and my journals and my laptop. Tried to breathe. I started to give my mind some freedom to wander. And we spent 2 weeks there, as I mentioned. The first week we spent in Galilee, and then the second week we spent all in Jerusalem. So on the first full day, we began early in the morning, and we loaded up the bus, and we began driving the windy roads of Galilee. And the first church that we visited was Capernaum, which is the fishing village in the Sea of Galilee where Jesus made his home. So we know he was born in Bethlehem, we know he spent his life as a child in Nazareth, but when he became an adult person and said, I have to figure out a place to live, he found this little village by the sea, and this is where he chose. And I was just enamored by just that alone, actually. That was enough to make the whole day. This idea that Jesus made this conscious decision to be in this small fishing village, that's where he wanted to spend his time. And as I walked around the grounds, Jesus felt so wonderfully ordinary there. I could picture him as just a human being who had to make a choice about where to live and who spent most of his day fishing, walking around. Lots of neighbors who were very, very close by. It's a very small little place. He felt less savior of the world and more boy next door. So when we made our way into the church, which was, it's really modern, actually, in contrast. But if you see in the center, it actually overlooks the place where they think St. Peter's mom's house was, which is where they worshiped. So it's like over the official church, right? And so I walked into this modern sanctuary, and I took my seat, I got my holy water, I did all the things, I sat down, I had a view of the sea, and I started into my determined, silent prayer. And of course, thoughts started coming in. What are Dan and the kids doing at home? What time is it at home? Am I hungry? How long do we have here before we have to go to the next thing? Am I keeping anybody? Am I peeking, opening my eyes? Am I holding up everybody because I'm still praying? Is everybody else gone? You know, you do what you can to move those things to the side and return back to that place of silence. And as I sat in that silence, I then felt like the words of the Lord's Prayer came rushing in. And for whatever reason, in that moment, I thought, oh, I'm supposed to listen to those words. I'm not going to push those words and those thoughts aside. And so I started praying the prayer, and I got to the point that said, give us this day. And I paused, and I smiled, and I thought, yes, that is what this place feels like for me today. It's just this day, this ordinary, extraordinary, healing whole day that Jesus has just because he lives in this village. He's a friend. He breaks bread. He laughs. He heals people. It's all just the day that Jesus has. And what we're asking is just for Jesus to give us that kind of day. And I sat there in the space of that phrase for a while, enjoying and smiling over that feeling. And then I finished the rest of the Lord's Prayer, opened my eyes, grateful that I hadn't held up everybody, and walked out the door. When we finished there, we got back into the van and drove for 32 seconds to the other, the next church stop. Wow, Galilee's really small. That's one of the first things on the first day. We were like, did anybody think it was going to be like Midland, Texas? Because it's really tiny, all the things. You can see why they walk everywhere. Totally doable. So we got into the van and we drove like right next door because there's an Eastern Orthodox church that's literally on the edge of what's official Capernaum. So, you know, the monks own this side, the Catholic Church owns this side, but right along the line, the Eastern Orthodox decided to have their church. And so we walked inside there, and of course there were beautiful murals everywhere on the walls. And you can't really tell, but there's, you know, you walk in and you're just hit with the smell of incense. And you can see that they do nothing but burn lots of incense all day, every day, because there's actually a patina and a haze on the walls. And they were actually fixing some of the murals as they have to sort of come and continually wipe it down. But it just felt beautifully saturating to me to be in that space. And so we walked around there. And again, I did my ritual of holy water and finding a spot and being in silent prayer. And I was determined this time that since I already had broken my one pilgrimage rule, because that's how bad I am at those things, I thought, no, now I'm really going to stick with the silence. And as I was in my silence in this space, again, I felt the Lord's Prayer coming in to my mind. And I thought, okay, this feels again like something that needs to be let in. So even though I attempted to move my thoughts to the side, I knew they were meant to be let in like light through a curtain. And so I let the curtain keep out all my other thoughts. And I let the prayer in as light and as gaze and as illumination. And what I experienced while praying the Lord's Prayer just a few yards from where I had been not 45 minutes before, it felt like a totally different prayer. The texture and the sound of it had changed. And it was as if the DNA strands of the prayer had unwound and reconfigured themselves in that small travel. There was no give us this day moment in this place. In fact, the word I remember, I didn't write about this in the book. I didn't write all the things that I experienced while praying this in my book. But the word that I remembered from being here, I got choked up when I got to the part where I said, glory. At the very end, I thought, oh, maybe this doesn't have a word or phrase. And then I hit glory and I thought, oh, there it is. There's the word for this place. Glory. And I thought of thousands of sticks of incense and all of the worship that has gone on in that place that is actually tangible in my nostrils and on the patina of the walls. And I thought, yes, glory, glory. So I left in that place, knowing that there was no boy next door here at the Eastern Orthodox Church, but there was glory, and it was Jesus, and he was somehow still just the same. So outside of that Eastern Orthodox Church, there was this big stone communion table, and I sat down at it, and I thought, well, I pondered this experience of praying this prayer and having such a visceral difference of experience between the two places. And without any formal declaration or decision on my part, that simply just became my pilgrimage practice. It claimed me. I just decided to bring the Lord's Prayer, or it decided to bring itself along for this pilgrimage. And I prayed it over the next 2 weeks, continually discovering Jesus there, entirely different and yet somehow also the same. Kind of like Jesus does from gospel to gospel or parable to parable, when you think you might begin to actually understand Jesus and then he says something totally different than what he just said before and you get confused again. How he always seems to catch us off guard and a little surprised, but then he actually seems more compelling for that, and so you stick with him anyways. And so it happened that for my 2 weeks of pilgrimage, I prayed this at every sanctuary we visited and a lot of places that weren't sanctuaries. And in each place, that prayer beckoned me to focus, and I found a sparklingly different facet of Jesus on which to gaze. There's this quote about the Torah that says, if you read the Torah, you turn it and turn it and turn it, for everything is in it. I don't know if you've heard that phrase before, but for me in this experience, I felt like the Lord's Prayer was this tangible reflection of light, this Jesus diamond. And I kept turning it and turning it and turning it, and realizing that everything of Jesus was in it. All of Jesus is somehow, to me, in this prayer. How does it encapsulate all of Jesus in this prayer? I don't know, but I felt like I experienced that. And I don't mean he's only there. I just mean that something about this encapsulates him in a way that allows us to see him more clearly. And why wouldn't it? Because it's his prayer, after all. It bears his name. It's his answer to the request that the disciples brought to him in Luke 11, which is one of their better and more accurate and relevant requests, if you ask me. They asked Jesus for a lot of really stupid things. This may be why he actually chose to answer them this one, because it wasn't the most ridiculous thing he's ever heard. They said, "Lord, teach us to pray." And Jesus told them, "Well, when you pray, say this." Which is a good thing, because it has some pretty bold demands of God in it. Bread and forgiveness and deliverance. And I may have been too shy to ask for those things on my own, knowing the way that we often are about those. So Jesus prays it for us, going first as he always does. And it's our turn then to follow. He's the gate, and the prayer is the doorway, an entrance, an invitation to experience the presence of Jesus. Turn it and turn it and turn it, for everything of Jesus is in it. For me, as I walked where Jesus prayed and ministered and lived and laughed, he became vibrant and alive in these words. He was so wonderfully boy next door in Capernaum. He was patient healer at the pools of Bethesda, at the pagan temple of Pan. He was the God who does not delight in sacrifices. In Gethsemane, he was utterly alone. He was frustrated and righteously angry at us and at all of humanity on Mount Zion, like a mother of endlessly bickering children should be. As we walked the Via Dolorosa, he was painfully perseverant as he made his way silently to the cross. At the place where we remember the loaves and the fishes, he was bread broken for us. At Armageddon, he was the ender of all wars. And in Palestinian Bethlehem, where the world is just as complicated today with its border security checks as it was when he was a child refugee there, Jesus was the embodiment of hope, literally the embodiment of hope come into the world. Jesus was revealed and illuminated at the intersection of the prayers that he taught and the places that he walked, so that he became both sharp and porous. Sharp, not only like a knife, although sometimes it felt like that, but sharp like high-definition TV, as if I could see his sunspots and his nose hairs. He became human and real and present. But also porous, not only like a mirage or a cloud, although he does seem just as undetectable as all of that, but porous like he was a sponge who would gather all the world into himself and was thirsty for it. Jesus taught us to pray with these words, and so I guess it shouldn't be surprising that the gift of these words includes the gift of him. The Lord's Prayer is a piece of him. It's a piece of him that contains his fullness, and we turn it and turn it and turn it again, for every part of him is in it. And we're nourished by the praying of it, because somehow in that prayer, as we travel along with it and bring it into our own lives, we live and move with Jesus, sharp and porous, deep and wide, Jesus here in time and space and beyond it. And then I returned home. And the smell of the Sea of Galilee became erased by the smell of untold piles of hockey gear in my garage. And I started to wonder if, and maybe more like hope that, the deepest truths are not limited to where Jesus prayed, but how Jesus prayed. Certainly, there's something special about being in the Holy Land. I hope if you are going on this trip that you too will feel that. My spiritual director before I went said, "You know, I'm not a real touchy-feely person," and oh, she isn't. That's why she's my spiritual director. But she said, "You know, when I was in the Holy Land, I thought there's just more Jesus here." She said, "I know that's actually, we're not supposed to say that, but you just feel like he left more of himself there than is normal," you know? And she said, "You come back and tell me if you think that's true." And I came back and I said, I feel what you're saying. You know, Pentecost, for sure, Pentecost. He's everywhere. But, yeah, there's something beautiful about being in the home, in the Holy Land. But isn't God with me at home too? Because of course, it's easy for me to say all of this about the Holy Land and about the Lord's Prayer when you're on pilgrimage and this is your view from your walk in the morning. I mean, who can't say nice things about that? A pilgrimage is by definition a journey to a particular place that holds value and meaning for you. So of course you're going to walk around and have all the feels. That's what you go for. But what happens when you board a plane home and you find yourself at Newark International Airport? What about when you're just back at work? What about when the baby had an explosive diaper, or your partner left their laundry on the floor again, or your boss is being a total jerk, or Facebook is filled with people rudely debating politics? What then? Where does the time and space go? Except I'm not sure that's the exactly right question. I think that maybe the question is, where do we go? We can get so caught up in other things, we just forget to take the time, which is so easy to do. Thankfully, it's also such an easy thing to fix. We just take the time back. We weren't taking the time 5 minutes ago. We can just take the time in the minute to come. We can just choose to. If we want time and space, Jesus himself tells us that all we have to do is ask for it. In Luke 11, right after Jesus tells the disciples how to pray, he continues, "So I say to you, ask and it will be forgiven. Search and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened for you. For everyone who asks received, and everyone who searches find, and for everyone who knocks, the door will be opened." Jesus seems to always be telling us, especially in Luke 11, to be very bold when we pray in our demands. It's such a bold claim. I wonder if we're brave enough to believe it and if we're brave enough to pray it as if it was true. I'm usually not. Apparently, though, when you're looking to find time and space, it's not just a matter of asking, but also a matter of entering. Because the Lord's Prayer isn't just a piece of beloved liturgy. It isn't just something to study or even primarily something to understand. It's something to inhabit. And if it's something that we inhabit, and if it's a time and space that's available to us everywhere, then it may not be and will not be just a pilgrimage thing after all. One of the problems for me when I returned, and this will make sense when you hear, since you heard about my theological overstuffedness at the beginning, is that, like, after all vacations, I got my brain back upon my return. My everyday brain. You probably have this one, the one that's rattling off endless to-do lists and thinking really mundane thoughts and wondering what to make for dinner. You don't worry about most of that stuff if you're on a good vacation, right? Which is why, at least for me, praying is easier there. Vacation spaciousness is delightful, but it doesn't last. And one of my many annoying traits is that I tend to think too much and ask too many questions. I don't know if you're like this, but for a good number of the people that I've pastored in my life, we can get distracted from prayer simply by thinking too much about it. What is this doing exactly when I pray? Like, how does it work? Like, if God already knows what I'm going to pray before I pray it, do I still have to say it aloud? Or, like, is it just an intuitive thing? Like, at what point does prayer, like, do I have to say it? I can't tell you how many times I've had this actual conversation as a pastor with people. Or, how do I know that it works? And what do I do when I feel that it's not working? How do I know God's listening? What's the point? Why does God allow suffering when I prayed so much for that one thing and I meant it? Did I not mean it enough? You can lose yourself in the thoughts and in the questions. And though I have opinions on all those very legitimate questions, part of me just wants to say, I don't know about all of that, really. Maybe the only thing I know for certain is that prayer is the conscious act of being with God. And maybe that's enough. Prayer is simply the conscious act of being with God. God is with us all the time. But for whatever reason, we don't go around being aware of it every second. It's like background music. And in prayer, we actually tune in and start listening to the sound. We enter into that reality of God's presence in a conscious way. Where does the time and space go? It goes with you, wherever you are, in prayer. When prayer is simply being consciously with God, it's magnificently portable. And no less powerful either. Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find it waiting. When we enter into prayer, we are brought home to God. And in that process, we are brought home, oh, I wasn't ready for that yet. We're brought home to our own lives. We inhabit prayer, and mysteriously and beautifully and wonderfully, prayer actually begins to inhabit us in a way that transforms us and transforms our daily lives. So since returning from the Holy Land and having this powerful experience, I've tinkered with bringing the Lord's Prayer along to much less glamorous destinations, like school carpool, the Starbucks drive-thru, the post office, which is my personal fifth circle of hell, my morning run, which is probably my sixth circle of hell, if I'm being honest, the animal shelter, family dinner. I also tinkered a little bit with this on pilgrimage, praying not only in churches, but I prayed on the bus and in a loud lobby and at lunchtime. Sometimes it got interesting, like when I saw white Jesus in Jerusalem, and I had a little bit of a moment, because if there's any place that should know that Jesus isn't white, it's the Holy Land, you guys. I had a bit of a problem, like, why is Jesus literally in Israel white right now? Look around. So I prayed the Lord's Prayer in front of that and just debated and prayed the juxtaposition. That was one of my less holy moments. That didn't make it into the book. I also prayed it when I got to Bethlehem and saw the Stars and Bucks Cafe, in which I also had a bit of a tirade about the things that we as Americans are exporting to places like Palestinian Bethlehem, and why, of all things we decide to export, this is what shows up. So I prayed the Lord's Prayer there too. The thing about Jesus to remember is that he really fits wherever we take him. That doesn't mean he's going to fit in. He likes to also make a scene every once in a while, and we appreciate that about him. But it's usually the juxtapositions that bring him out the clearest anyway. So pilgrimaging with the Lord's Prayer is kind of like a combination of the rosary and the labyrinth, where the prayer maintains its ritualistic repetition, but it moves out of sacred space into the wider world that God loves and is always redeeming. So my challenge to you is to take the Lord's Prayer with you the rest of this week. Take it with you as much as you can, as often as you can remember. Just take a moment in the midst of your day from time to time to pause and pray the Lord's Prayer. Pray these words and see what bubbles up to the surface for you. What happens when you take a moment to call God's name holy on the bustling tollway? Or when you pray God's will to be done when you sit at your desk, or when you ask for daily bread at the gym? Or when you seek forgiveness while you're scrolling through social media? Where will you be when you declare that God's kingdom is the power and the glory forever? How will Jesus inhabit and maybe invade your daily rhythms when you bring his prayer into your life and your routine? How will it help you to remember this most holy truth, which is that God is among us in this moment and the next moment and the next moment? And that God's presence has the power and the potential to transform us all the time. Praying is in inhabiting. Maybe this is what Paul meant when he encouraged us to pray without ceasing. I always wondered about that as a kid. Like, how do you get anything done if you're just praying all the time? I just thought less of Paul, that he probably just never built as many boats as he said. Maybe that isn't with words, though, that we are praying without ceasing, but with a posture as one who walks in the realm of God and not only prays, but lets the words pray her as well and become a home. Maybe prayer is asking and seeking and knocking and walking along while we're waiting for the answers. Maybe it's praying in such a way that the answer or the next step or the illumination that we're looking for comes to us because we find that we were already walking right toward it. If prayer is the conscious act of being with God, maybe you've not only been walking toward it, but walking in it already this whole time. And though this is indeed life-giving space, I feel it's important to mention that it is not all rainbows and happiness. Walking in this prayer comes with a word of caution. Because one thing that I definitely noticed while praying the Lord's Prayer in the Holy Land is that it is subversive, rebellious, and bold. It can get you in very big trouble, which is something we will face up close in a couple of weeks as we walk through Passion Week. The Lord's Prayer was actually part of what's called the Disciplina Arcana, which is the secret disciplines that were taught to new converts early in the first and second centuries. These secret disciplines people felt, Christians felt at that time, they were too holy and precious for just anyone to know it. And so you kind of had to prove that you were really in this for the long haul before they were going to tell it for you. And for them, that was baptism, which was a very long process of proving that you really, really were intent about following the way of Jesus. And these secret disciplines were handed down once you had become baptized, when they knew you were real, and they were handed down as oral tradition, often with a whisper. They wanted you to know how holy and powerful this prayer was, and that it wasn't just left for anybody. And at first blush, this may feel so weird to us, because we live in a society where we know plenty of non-Christians who could also say the Lord's Prayer by heart. My son goes to school here, and every day he sits next to one of his best friends who's Muslim, and they go to chapel every day, and they both say it together, which I would like to say for the record, I think is awesome. But if you told the first and second century people this, they would be absolutely confused at how everyone just knew this secret prayer. It's everywhere, actually. The Lord's Prayer shows up in movies and in TV shows and scenes, not to mention t-shirts. This is an actual t-shirt that you can buy. Coffee cups. It's written inside ceramic crosses. A few weeks ago, the First Lady started her first ever public speech with the Lord's Prayer. The idea that this prayer was ever a secret seems unfathomable to us because we're so saturated with it. But when you think of the Disciplina Arcana in context, it makes perfect sense. Because what they knew and what we have forgotten is that the Lord's Prayer is a call to subvert the most dominant power structures that are operating in our world. That was true then, and it's true now as well. I was reading a book by a Franciscan, Michael Crosby, and he says, most if not all of the phrases of the Our Father called for the creation of conditions on earth that would be considered counter to those of first and second century environments. At that time, citizens were required to profess allegiance to the empire, to affirm the holiness of the emperor, and to voluntarily submit to his will. The will of the emperor, we know, was not exactly in line with things like giving people daily bread or forgiving them or delivering them from evil. So to declare allegiance to God and to God's kingdom was an act of treason against the empire. It's why the Disciplina Arcana had to exist in the first place. Christians were persecuted because of their faith, because it was seen as a threat to the empire and everything that it stood for. And they were right. It's a bold act to pray the Lord's Prayer. What we're asking for in this prayer is not the small niceties of religion, but an upheaval of much of the way that we operate in society. Crosby continued in his book with a story about his dissonance of being at a seminary and learning about the Disciplina Arcana, and then he hopped into his car, and when he turned it on, there was a pop song of the Lord's Prayer bustling through the airwaves. And he thought, this is strange. And he wrote, if it is now acceptable for the system literally to capitalize on what once delegitimized society, then we must consider how the Our Father evolved to this state from its origins of prayer and ministry. That's a heavy question for tonight, to ask how we got to that point, that it became a pop song that you could buy for $1.99. And it's one beyond an easy answer. But at the very least, what we can remember is that praying this prayer is not a domesticating sort of spiritual discipline. Frankly, any good spiritual discipline is not going to be domesticating. I remember Frederick Buechner's words, where he says that to pray the Lord's Prayer is to invite the tiger out of the cage, to unleash a power that makes atomic power look like a warm breeze. So yes, we inhabit this prayer, but we cannot forget that the life it brings and the transformation that it seeks also will bring our comfort into question. If I were a betting woman, I would guess that it would take you less than a week of you carting the Lord's Prayer around in your own life before you came to this conclusion on your own. This prayer moves things and demands things, which is why I feel like it's trustworthy to say that they're Jesus' words. And it's why after 2,000 years, we still pray them regularly across this globe. They've got staying power, because God has no intention of going anywhere. God is here in time and space, and that is not without consequence. God does not ask us to absentmindedly follow, but for us to faithfully obey. So there's a sign at the entrance to the Church of the Nativity. It says, "We're hoping that if you enter here as a tourist, you would exit as a pilgrim. If you enter here as a pilgrim, you would exit as a holier one." And though they mean it for the millions of church visitors that come through their doors every year from all faiths and no faith, looking for all kinds of different things, I think the same thing can be said for people of faith who are seeking to enter into a life of prayer. One way to explain the difference between a tourist and a pilgrim is that a tourist is an outsider, and a pilgrim is an indweller. A tourist tends to encounter things at a distance, looking more through their lens than their heart. But a pilgrim travels with his whole self, seeking to indwell the place that he beholds. One of them seeks recreation, and the other is seeking transformation and recreation. At least from what we know, as Jesus says it in Luke 11, it's not about where we are as much as it is what we're looking for when we pray. Which brings us back to our own lives, filled as they are with meetings and laundry and broken air conditioning units. Prayer can feel like just something else that we need to do. But seeing prayer as being simply conscious with God, present with God, takes a bit of the pressure off, and it puts some joy back in, I think. Prayer becomes the radical act of just showing up and trusting the rest to the movement of the Spirit. And I'm convinced that when we find our home in prayer, we actually find our home in our own lives as well. We will find perhaps the next step in our path as we figure out what it means for us to walk as followers of Jesus in Dallas, Texas in 2017. What does that look like for us? We find it by listening and inhabiting this practice of prayer. And if we aren't careful, this prayer will transform us as we declare our allegiance to this very different kind of kingdom. Prayer is a doorway, a wardrobe entrance into a mysterious parallel world of Jesus in all his fullness. And if we carry it with us, even haphazardly as we go about our day, and if we find some silence in there from time to time to notice a word or a phrase or a feeling that comes up in our praying, we find our way into the heart of God. We move from praying the prayer to inhabiting it. So what would it look like for you to take this prayer with you as your traveling companion for a day or a week, or if you're really wanting to try it, maybe a month? How does Jesus reveal himself to you at the intersection of the prayer and the places that you live and walk and minister and love and work? Our Father, who is in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For yours is the kingdom and the power forever. Amen. Thank you.